Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Sarah Kellogg, registration number 39236, and I represent Mr. Samuspina in this case. I hope to reserve approximately 4 minutes of my time for rebuttal. The state's interpretation of the felony murder statute in this case dramatically expands the rule to include conduct that is not truly based on one of the enumerated predicate felonies for felony murder. The felony murder rule was intended to classify a death as a first-degree murder when it occurred as part of the commission of certain predicate felonies, arson, robbery, burglary, escape, kidnapping, and certain sexual assaults, because the legislature deemed those were particularly inherently dangerous. Notably, violation of a protection order is not one of those predicate felonies. What distinguishes this case also is that Mr. Samuspina was invited into the apartment. And as I explained in my opening brief, the definition for the element in burglary of unlawful entry or remain unlawfully is that the person was not licensed, invited, or privileged to enter the dwelling. Here he was invited, so it simply is not burglary.
Counsel, even if we were to accept your argument, what about the idea that the defendant would have unlawfully remained after an invitation was implicitly revoked when the fight started, and that would constitute a burglary?
Well, Judge, I think there's a couple reasons why the court can't find that adequate in this case. One is that was never argued below. That was not the state's theory. That theory was presented for the first time in the answer brief.
Do you have any authority saying that the jury is limited to the state's theory when they are otherwise instructed on the elements of unlawfully remaining?
Your Honor, I did recently find a case from the United States Supreme Court, and I'd be happy to provide supplemental briefing if this court's interested. But that's Dunn v. United States, 442 U.S. 100 from 1979. And the argument below that was a organized crime case about false declarations, and the issue was which false declaration the defendant had made, and the state proceeded based on one false declaration, and the Tenth Circuit affirmed based on a second false declaration. And Justice Marshall wrote, the indictment charged inconsistency between petitioner's statements in the September 30th interview of his grand jury testimony. That was also the theory on which the case was tried and submitted to the jury.
And that's okay, but in this instance, the information explicitly listed not only unlawfully entering, but potentially unlawfully remaining as well.
That's right. So here the Justice Marshall is discussing the factual basis. So that's true. The charging instrument and the jury instructions contained the standard elemental for burglary, but this is a sufficiency of the evidence issue. So we're looking at the evidence that the prosecutor relied on, presented to the defense that it was going to rely on, presented to the jury, the entire theory of the case. And Justice Marshall writes, to uphold a conviction on a charge that was neither alleged in an indictment nor presented to a jury at trial offends the most basic notions of due process.
Was that a sufficiency of evidence case, Dunn versus the United States?
Go ahead. It was discussed below in the Tenth Circuit as a variance, and what he's saying is that there is no variance issue. The theory that they presented below was based on this first statement, and now the court is affirming based on this later in time statement, and you can't do
so that. So was it a sufficiency of evidence case? The reason why I ask counsel is, as you remember, there are some fairly dramatic consequences that attach to a determination of insufficient evidence. Double jeopardy prohibits retrial.
Certainly. And, you know, in this case, again, I think this case is clear that this was not a felony murder. This was second-degree murder, which he was convicted of, and that would be reinstated, and a violation of a protection order. The prosecutor in this case used violation of protection order to satisfy the two critical elements that make up a burglary. So, in essence, there was no distinction between violation of protection order and burglary. And you have to have the burglary to get to felony murder.
Well, when this court is reviewing sufficiency of the evidence, my understanding is that we look at the quantity and quality of the evidence. And so why should the theory that the prosecutor chose to argue control our analysis of the quantity and quality of the evidence.
I think for two reasons. And one, just to run back to the Stone case, and again, I'm happy to provide supplemental briefing. Justice Marshall goes on, the offense is not so defined, and appellate courts are not free to revise the basis on which a defendant is convicted simply because the same result would likely obtain a retrial. And, you know, so to answer your question in two parts, the first part is that idea that, you know, this is an appeal. This isn't the trial. We're looking at a cold record. We're not, you know, looking at the witnesses and doing all the things that a jury would do. So to just, you know, this court does look at that in terms of just a straight sufficiency argument. Is the evidence sufficient? Is it not? But here, they're arguing for an entirely separate basis than was ever presented or fleshed out or, you know, relied on at all below. So there's just a dramatic lack of evidence. And the second reason is, in the answer brief, the state relied on People v. Davis to support its argument that this notion that the court can affirm on any basis if there's substantial and sufficient evidence. Well, and that was the Court of Appeals case in Davis, and that's in the answer brief. I have the cite somewhere. That was 2012 COA 1, and they cite paragraph 83. So that was the Court of Appeals opinion from another division of this court. Davis, since the reply brief has been filed, Davis was overruled on that issue by the Supreme Court. And in that case, that was not exactly a sufficiency of the evidence case. That was a double jeopardy case. And the court found there wasn't double jeopardy because there was enough evidence to find two separate conduct supporting two separate crimes, possession and distribution. And in the Supreme Court, Chief Justice Rice said, no, in fact, you know, there might be an inference that there could be this other quantum of drugs that would support the possession, but it's just a slight inference, and on the basis of these facts, we can't say beyond a reasonable doubt that there was sufficient evidence. And so I think that just highlights the problems with an appellate court reviewing an entirely separate theory for the evidence than was relied on below.
Ms. Taylor, just to make sure I'm following you on the Davis discussion,
mm-hmm.
I thought you earlier said it was a double jeopardy question. Are you saying instead it was sufficiency of the evidence question?
So it was sufficiency for whether there was two separate conduct supporting two separate acts to avoid a double jeopardy problem. It was, so no, it wasn't a sufficiency of the evidence claim that the evidence was insufficient to support the conviction overall, but it was that there was possession and distribution, and the question was there more than one quantum of drugs to support a separate possession charge, or did possession merge into the distribution?
Okay, thank you.
There's sufficient evidence of distribution. So this court reviews sufficiency of the evidence arguments all the time, but what's unique about this case here is that we're now dealing with a novel issue that was raised in the answer brief for the first time on appeal. And so I don't think that this court can find, based on the evidence presented below, that there was substantial and sufficient evidence to find that he remained unlawfully, that the invitation to be in the apartment was somehow implicitly withdrawn, and he remained unlawfully. For all the reasons I've cited, for Dunn v. United States, for the fact that Davis highlights the problems with an appellate court doing that, for the fact that it wasn't fleshed out below. So there really isn't sufficient evidence to rely on that part of that element in burglary. And then finally,
Ms. Kellogg, I'm not sure I'm wrong. I thought earlier you were saying because this theory of unlawful remain wasn't presented below, therefore we should not address the question at all. But now you're saying even if we addressed it, there's not sufficient evidence in the record to support the theory of unlawful remain?
Yeah, I think that you shouldn't address it. Absolutely, Judge. I don't think that you should address it. I think that's it's due process, it's unfair, it usurps the jury trial and everything. Everything I've been arguing. But yes, but also secondarily, you know, were this court to address it, I think there's two problems with this court addressing the remain unlawfully part of burglary. One is, I don't think that there is substantial and sufficient evidence that Mr. Sanchez even remained unlawfully in the apartment after some implicit withdrawal of the invitation. Secondly, if this court did think that there was sufficient evidence and therefore that potentially a burglary occurred, that gets to the second part of my sufficiency argument, which is once you have a burglary, Ms. Cressman was a participant in that burglary, and so he can't be guilty of felony murder.
Well, if the theory was that he remained unlawfully because the invitation had been revoked as a consequence of the assault, how could she be a participant in that remaining unlawfully?
So she might, Judge, to answer that, she might not be a participant in that element of burglary, but she certainly was a participant in the second critical element of burglary, which is intent to commit therein a crime. So she participated because that was charged only, again, as violation of a protection order. She participated with the intent to commit that crime of violation of a protection
order. Well, there are a number of potential violations of the protection order in this case. One is the initial entry.
Mm-hmm.
One is, they don't contact, don't injure her.
Mm-hmm.
So did she participate in that perhaps further violation of
She certainly participated in the contact part of it. She called him 41 times in the 2 weeks preceding. She invited him over. She told him to get in the apartment. She was in contact with him, and that conduct was the basis for that element of burglary that supports the felony murder charge. So she participated in the intent to commit therein the crime of violating the protection order.
So Ms. Kellogg, under your theory, if the victim had lived, would she have been prosecuted as a complicitor for violation of her own protective order?
Whether she has some sort of criminal liability as a complicitor, I don't think this court even has to go that far at all. The question is just a participant. And in my opening brief, I used complicity to sort of highlight the definition, because there is no legal definition of participant. But certainly here, Mr. Santos even is the defendant, and the state has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he committed all the elements of felony murder. And one of those elements is the death of someone other than a participant. So they have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt she's not a participant.
So in the classic felony murder, the robber kills the cashier. If the cashier participates by handing over money and gets killed, there's no felony murder in that situation?
I don't think that would be. So in my reply brief, I give the definition of participant from Webster's Third Dictionary, which is one that takes part or shares in something with others. So it's looking at that you are actually participant, and this is kind of where complicity is a little helpful to just sort of define this, participant in that predicate felony. So you're involved with encouraging, aiding, sharing that predicate felony. At gunpoint, handing over money is not that. So no, I don't think that would be the case. I think someone who participates because they are, a co-conspirator, or even just, helping someone or sharing in it, or in this case, intending to commit the same crime therein.
Do you think a participant to satisfy this is a complicitor then? Or do you think?
I think a complicitor would satisfy,
okay,
but it's not necessary.
It's not necessary. What different then? What different? Say you're not a complicitor. How else are you satisfying?
I mean, I think this case, I think she doesn't have to be legally culpable as a complicitor. I think this case, intending to commit the crime therein of contacting Mr. Sam Steven in violation of the protection order, because that was the basis, that conduct was the basis for element six of burglary, was enough. That makes sense. I'll reserve the remainder of the time for rebuttal.
And you're going to get 2 minutes more. 2 minutes more on her rebuttal. She asked for 4, and I took up way too much of your time, so you're going to have some more time when you come back.
Thank you, Governor.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Brock Swanson, attorney registration number 39116, and I represent the people of the state of Colorado. In this case, the defendant knew that there was a protection order prohibiting him from contacting the victim. Nevertheless, he went to her apartment. While he was inside the apartment, neighbors heard banging noises, and the victim began screaming for help. She tried to flee the apartment, but the defendant pulled her back inside and locked the door. He then stabbed her in the back and neck, killing her. When the defendant killed the victim, the jury could have reasonably concluded that based on the victim's cries for help and resistance to the victim's attack, that she had withdrawn any invitation into her apartment and thus that he was unlawfully remaining in the apartment. And the jury could have reasonably concluded that when she withdrew the invitation, any participation in the underlying burglary ended. And I think this is a pretty straightforward application of people the Agger and the cases cited there and recognizing.
Well, let me ask you, let's go back to the fundamental question I believe that the counsel posed is, how fair is it to convict someone on a theory that's not presented to the jury, or to uphold a conviction based on a theory not presented to the jury?
I think in this case, there was not a lot of argument about how is that about this particular element of the offense. There was a little argument from defense counsel about the invitation, that arguing that it had been invited inside, so that issue was presented to the jury. They were said that it was an argument
the issue of unlawfully remaining was presented to the jury?
The issue that was presented was that the defendant argued that the victim had invited him inside, and therefore that he could not have committed a burglary. And so that argument was squarely in front of them. And the response to that, I think the jury and anyone could reasonably conclude from that, and what was recognized in this case, is that, okay, even if that's the case, under the facts of this case, the invitation did not encompass this. It did not, it was withdrawn when the defendant began attacking her, and she did not encourage that. I think also, as far as the participation goes, I don't think there's any argument that the defendant encouraged the defendant in any way to violate the protection order by injuring her, by stabbing her, and that was what was occurring. That was the violation that was occurring when she was killed. I don't think there's any authority that I'm aware of that says that in a sufficiency of the evidence analysis, the evidence is evaluated only based on those things expressly argued by the prosecution during its arguments. Instead, the jury's given the law, it's given the facts, and applying the law to those facts are what the jury is supposed to do. That's their domain, and they're presumed to be able to do that well, to find the facts and apply them to the law that's given to them by the judge. And indeed, they're always instructed that they need to apply the law as it's given by the judge and not as it's explained by the prosecution. They can use that to help them, but they're bound by the law given by the judge. And here, they were instructed on the unlawfully remains portion of that.
Mr. Swanson, was there any argument presented about the victim's authority to be actually invite someone in violation of the protective order?
Not really. The argument the prosecution argued that the defendant received this protection order, and the protection order clearly told them that the defendant could not have invited him inside, and that he could not go inside. The victim could not invite him inside. That this was a court order that prohibited him from entering in, even if he thought that the victim was inviting him inside. That the victim did not have the ability to give him that permission. And so I think even if we don't look at the unlawfully remains element, that there is also sufficient evidence that he unlawfully entered.
Unlawfully entered, there is case law saying, you're not licensed or you're not privileged to enter in violation of a protection order, even if you are asked in. With respect to the violation protection order statute, but the violation of, or the unlawfully enters and remains definition includes a term that goes beyond privilege or license, doesn't it? It goes to invite.
Yes, and I think that if you look at like that the case of the Garfinkel there versus People versus Smith, that in that case the defendant, they found, could not lawfully enter his own residence that he owned. He owned the residence, and so he would otherwise be privileged or licensed to go into his own residence. It was his own place that he owned. And his wife told him that there had been a protection order. And they found just that he knew that there was a protection order. That was enough to essentially revoke for this purposes of the, for burglary, his ability to rely on this privilege or license that he would otherwise have. And I think that's the same thing here. What we're talking about is he otherwise, is that in the absence of the protection order, he would be, an invitation would permit him to lawfully enter. But
Do you have any authority indicating that a victim's express invitation is negated by a term of law in the protection order context?
Not in the protection order context. The closest case that I found was in People versus McNeese, where this was a Make My Day case, and they were interpreting the term uninvited. And in that case, someone had invited one of the victims. The question is whether that victim was uninvited for Make My Day purposes. And they were considering whether that person, because they were expressly invited by another person who was living there, who would ordinarily appear to have the authority to do that, would make it an uninvited entry so that the Make My Day statute wouldn't apply. And I'm sorry, I'm not saying this very clearly. The court concluded that it needed to remand. This was a community proceeding, so they remanded for further findings as to whether it would apply, to find out whether the person there knew that they entry was unlawful, even though there was an invitation, because the invitation was not authorized, because the person who gave it didn't have the authority to actually extend that invitation. And here it's very clear that the defendant was informed that the victim here could not authorize him to come into the apartment.
You could not for purposes of the protection order statute, but isn't it different when the burglary contains some other provisions in defining unlawfully enters and remains?
I don't think so. I think that the issue is we're talking about an unlawful entry, and he could not lawfully accept an invitation. He could not lawfully accept an invitation into the apartment. It would be a violation of the law for him to do so. And because that is a violation of the law, he could not lawfully enter.
You know, is that kind of circular? He could not lawfully accept an invitation unless he was invited into the. Even if he was invited, under the definition of unlawfully enters or remains, the one that says, you know, invited, does not negate the unlawfulness for purposes of the burglary statute?
Well, I mean, you could say the same thing about, like, privilege. You could say an owner of a house is privileged to enter that house and say, okay, so this person owns the house, so if it's their house, they can go into it, and it's not burglary. And in People Who Smith, they rejected that and said, no, even though you would otherwise be privileged, because there's a protection order that says you can't do this, you can't lawfully do this.
Doesn't privilege or license, or could there be a passive sense to privilege or license, whereas the invitation is affirmative conduct?
I don't know that I see a meaningful difference there.
The word invitation doesn't mean anything in that statute?
Let's take the situation.
I take the answer was it doesn't mean anything in that statute?
It means something if the person can invite them. I guess, like, let's say that you have someone, like, there are two burglars, they go together to the house. One of them goes inside and then says, why don't you come in with me? and then they, the other person comes in. I don't think they were invited. They just were invited by someone they knew didn't have the authority to lawfully invite them inside. It can't just mean anybody has invited them into the premises. It has to mean someone who they know can lawfully invite them. Otherwise, I think it would be an absurd interpretation of that provision.
Let me ask you one other question, and I'll try to remain silent for your time. Are you familiar with the case of, cited by opposing counsel of I think it was Dunn versus the United States?
Yeah, I think I've seen it before. I definitely did not review it in preparation for this. If I'm recalling correctly, it was a case where there was an indictment and the prosecution had proceeded on a theory that was not included within the
How about this question?
The facts set forth in the indictment, they were found by the grand jury in that proceeding.
Was it cited in the briefs by the parties?
I don't believe so.
Are you going to need time to respond then to a new authority cited for the first time in oral argument?
I mean, unless this court thinks it's necessary, I'm happy to.
Well, you can leave it up to me. I think it's not necessary.
Okay.
Then. But it's up to you, counsel.
I'll take a chance and I can let you know by the end of the day if I feel like I'll take a look at it and see if I think there's anything that needs to be responded to.
I think perhaps we need to be a little bit more definite. If you need a chance, I will allow you to have a chance till, say, Friday to write us something on it. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure I'm going to say, go ahead, walk out of the courtroom and then contact us and tell us if you want to write something. Would you, how about this? Okay. Have until Friday to submit something in writing, no longer than a page and a half on Dunn versus the United States, and only Dunn versus the United States.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Any questions?
I don't think any response is warranted. Should I let you know or just?
That would be fine if you would. That would be a great courtesy.
Okay.
And I apologize. I hadn't asked my colleagues whether they also had agreed with this, but hopefully this procedure will allow you a fair chance to respond to Dunn by Friday if you so wish.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. A page and a half, and the bailiff will reduce this to an order for the record. Thank you. Okay. And by the way, would you please add another minute to his time since I took up his time? I apologize, counsel.
No, that's fine. I'm just here to answer questions. That's good. I guess just a couple more things I could say. As far as the being a participant, as I discussed earlier, I think that any participation she may have had ended when she withdrew the invitation. But I think that also, whatever participant means, it can include the victim of the crime. Like, even though perhaps the term is the common understanding could be read that broadly, and to that extent maybe it's ambiguous, that would be an absurd result. That it has to mean something more than just the victim of the crime to be a participant. And I think also, kind of flowing from that, if the victim here was not a complicitor, then I don't know how she could have been a participant in the burglary of her own house. Like, how she could have had any sort of, that this should require some sort of criminal culpability, shared criminal culpability on the part of them. And if that could come through complicity, and I know as I discussed in the brief, I think there's sufficient evidence for the jury to conclude that she was not a complicitor, even in the initial entry, that she couldn't be a participant in this because she just could not have had any criminal culpability related to her own entering and remaining in her own home, which she would have had the authority to grant ordinarily. She would have as to herself, she would just have. And again, this, the question is not whether the jury could have found that she was a participant, but whether it had to under this the evidence of this case, because this is a sufficiency of the evidence challenge. So there are no further questions. We'd ask that this court confirm the defendants.
Thank you, counsel.
Excuse me, Your Honors, in the Dunn case, which it's true, I did not cite in my reply brief, but I just want to point out at Pennsite 106, the court said, notes that there was facts that supported both of the prior statements that were presented to the jury, but prosecution proceeded only on the theory based on the earlier statement and the September 30th interview. And the court said, while there was no variance between the indictment and proof at trial, there was a discrepancy between the basis on which the jury rendered its verdict and that on which the Court of Appeals sustained the petitioner's conviction. Where the jury was instructed to rest its decision on the September statement, the 10th Circuit whereas the jury was instructed to rest its decision on the September statement, the 10th Circuit predicated its affirmance on the October testimony.
And Ms. Kellogg, on that point, was the jury verdict specific about which statement it was relying on?
You know, I don't know. I apologize again because I didn't include this in my reply brief. I don't know. It originally came up as a variance issue because they were saying the proofs were different from what was charged, but there was facts supporting both of the statements presented below. It was, but they only went forward on the one theory. So my guess is maybe they were instructed or it was clear.
Thank you.
That it would have been that earlier statement. But here it was equally clear, even though the language of the jury instructions, even though the language of the jury instructions was just based on the statutory elements, so it didn't specifically say, we're only charging based on the unlawful entry and not the remain unlawfully. The remain unlawfully was there. But the theory below is clearly, it was never, ever, ever raised to the jury that remain unlawfully could have been an option.
Ms. Keller, could you address the hypothetical about one burglar inviting another into a third party's home and that being an invitation?
Clearly someone can't invite you into someone else, into not their home.
Because they have no authority?
They have no authority.
Well,
yeah.
Under the prosecution's theory, the victim has no authority once there's a protective order in place.
Yeah, I entirely disagree. I mean, the victim has the authority. The protection order applies only to the defendant and his conduct, and entering that apartment violates the protection order. It in no way, and she's the protected party. It doesn't impact her authority based on being the occupant of the dwelling for whom she can invite into the apartment.
But she can't authorize him to violate the protection order, can she?
No, and he.
So her authority is affected somewhat by this protection order.
Only as to his conduct. It doesn't impact. Right. The protection order says even if she invites you over, you're still violating the protection order. So.
That's okay. I get your point. Thank you.
You get my point. Okay. Sorry.
That's okay.
I was getting interested for a second. But it didn't impact her authority at all about whom she could invite into her apartment. And there's nothing in the protection order that says that. She's just a protected party. But back to the fact that the theory was only based on the unlawful entry and not remain unlawfully, that's what the, and if I could just finish my thought very briefly,
yes,
I may be getting extra time already.
Please.
But that is exactly what the prosecutor argued in closing argument. He said, when he knowingly crossed the threshold, he was unlawfully in the dwelling. When the door closed, he was unlawfully in there. It doesn't matter whether she invited him, it's done. And that's what the jury was presented with. I ask this court to reverse. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both, counsel, for your excellent arguments in this case. The case will stand submitted in due course. Thank you both very much.